The Daily Connect Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Connect Podcast then for the 9th of January 2019. It is Wednesday and it's Stephen Scott here with you. We've got lots to talk about, including the Bird Box Challenge, our conversation this week on the Netflix movie that has spawned a challenge for people out there to try life with a blindfold on. Yeah, sounds insane. But yeah, people are doing this. And, you know, it's okay if it's in the house or if you're just kind of mucking around at home or near where you live. But people are actually going out onto big streets, you know, big cars running at them and all the rest of it. So, you know, dangerous stuff. So people are, including Netflix, have already said, look, please don't do this. But we wanted to get your take on it from the blind point of view. Is this a good thing? Is it a good idea that people do this? Is it harmless fun or is it just a passing fad or is it dangerous? Well, we'll get your views on that a bit later. Also, we're going to be talking about CES 2019. It's the Consumer Electronics Show happening right now in Las Vegas. We're going to get the very latest, including some big news for blind people in the form of a new smart cane. We're going to talk about that. Producer Andy joining us for those stories a bit later. And as well as all of that, we are going to be finding out about sport as well. We're going to be hearing from Archie Labsley. He tells us how he got involved in rugby. By going along just to a local rugby club and thought he would try it out. Having the confidence to go in is often the challenge, especially when it's a mainstream club. Well, he did, and he gives us some important tips on that. So that's coming up. But first, we meet John Nixie. John met up with our own Lynn Morgan, who's our RNIB content producer in Cardiff. She was at a Pause for Chat class where people with guide dogs and others come along and meet and just catch up, really. A nice event. And Lynn sat down with John, who has dual sensory loss and is a music composer.
John has dual sensory loss, and towards the end of 2018, he became involved in a memorial service. Before John talked me through his part in the ceremony, he began by telling me about his sight loss.
I was registered blind in 1985. I'd been partially sighted from birth. There's a hereditary condition, retinitis pigmentosa. And I was then registered with a partial hearing loss in 1994. Well, I had the opportunity of being involved in a memorial service in Abbotsleary, and a friend of mine adjured one of the pieces of music I wrote about 18 years ago, and he asked me to put lyrics to it. Two young girls were murdered in my hometown back in 1921, and there'd been a huge community effort to fund their memorial stones back then.
In 1921, 8-year-old Frieda Bonnell was sent by her father to buy birdseed in a local shop but never returned. Frieda was served that morning by 15-year-old Harold Jones. Her handkerchief was found in the shop, but many people said Harold was innocent, even though he was charged with murder and stood trial. Denying everything, Harold was acquitted due to lack of evidence and returned to his home. 17 days later, 11-year-old Florence Flossie Little was murdered. Florence's body was found at Harold's home, concealed in the attic. Harold was tried and found guilty of Florence's murder. 2 months too young for the death penalty, Harold was sent to Usk Prison for life, where he admitted to murdering Frieda. Eventually, Harold was released on parole in 1941. He died in 1971.
A friend of mine had written a couple of books about the murders, and family members wanted to go and visit the graves, and he found them very embarrassing because of the dilapidated state that they were in. So back at the end of last year, he started up another community effort to raise, think it was £3,000 to restore the graves. They were done at cost, which made it much more reasonable to be able to achieve. And as part of that event that was held at the Met in Abertillery, he wanted to use one of my pieces of music as part of the programme that afternoon. The only problem was he didn't want to use the instrumental version. He wanted lyrics written to it, which wasn't easy to do. I've never been a lyricist, and I was concerned that I wouldn't be able to do a suitably good job on the lyrics, but everyone seemed satisfied with it by the time I'd finished it, so I think I did okay in the end.
When did your interest in music begin?
I was brought up in more or less a musical household, really. My dad was a musician. I knew him as a pianist, but when he was young, he was in the Abertillery Youth Orchestra. He played the viola. My sister has got a very wide taste in music, and she loves singing. My mother, unfortunately for us, although she loved music, she was tone deaf. So we had all avenues of music in our family. But my dad was the main one who gave me all the encouragement when I was learning to play the violin when I was in school. He taught me to play the piano when I was a teenager. And it was that then that led to friends, having heard me playing the piano, suggested that I should try making my own compositions. But it just never interested me at all. But they carried on gently persuading until probably 2 years later, after they first started, I decided one day that I'd sit down and give it a go and see what I could come up with. And I probably spent 6 years composing about 70 pieces, all told.
Well, there's a very interesting story about the composing part. We're going to hear more on that coming up a bit later here on the Daily Connect podcast. Stick around for
the
that.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Let's talk about the Bird Box Challenge then. And producer Andy is with me here today.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Right, let's talk about this because I know that lots of people have been getting in touch and, you know, it's become a thing on Twitter. People have been not just doing it, but actually talking about it as well. And we thought we'd get some views of blind people because, you know, ultimately what this is about is how blind people live their lives. And this suggestion that's coming from some people, I've seen a few tweets like this, not sort of within the blind world, but just in the world out there, saying things like, well, you know, if Sandra Bullock can live her life with a blindfold on, then maybe I could. And then maybe that raises the question, well, you know, what's all these blind people complaining about? You know, life is simple.
Yeah.
I was able to make a cup of tea yesterday and I didn't scold myself. And, you know, I just wonder if this is a sensible thing. I get worried when people just go off with their own ideas.
Yeah, where has this come from?
Well, I think a lot of it is it sometimes reinforces stereotypes that are already in place.
You know,
sometimes you'll see this kind of thing and you think, well, you know, I've often thought those blind people are at it.
Yeah, reinforces that side of things, yeah. The Guardian article that I read yesterday summed it up best by saying that it's people filming themselves completing everyday tasks while blindfolded without much success.
Yes.
And that's the problem. And we heard from Holly, who we spoke to last year, Life of a Blind Girl blog. She wrote in to us and said that it does. It reinforces misconceptions and stereotypes which some of us, she's referring to herself in this instance, so hard to tackle. That way of saying, well, it's not a case of just putting on a blindfold and all, I'm blind, and it wasn't things bad.
Mm.
Because you've had years and years of experience of getting used to that and working around that. So she says, as a blogger, I try to educate people on sight loss and I tackle the common misconceptions surrounding visual impairment and disability. This is something that I'm passionate about, but I think this challenge goes against what some of us work so hard on. So that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, so it's kind of reinforcing the stereotypes, as I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But you were reading an article yesterday which says that actually this is a scientific fact. I mean, they've done studies on this kind of thing, haven't they?
Yeah, that was in the Guardian article that it's working against. If you just put a blindfold on and all of a sudden you're wondering, well, I can't make a cup of tea anymore, or I can't get down the stairs anymore, or isn't life bad as a blind?
Mm.
That works as against the negative of, well, it's not all negative. Just because you're blind or partially sighted doesn't mean that you can't do those things. You can, because you've worked around it.
You see, the thing is, I mean, we work for the RNIB, so, you know, people in this building, in this office and this organisation will often say things to me, especially the sighted people who work here, will say things to me like, well, you know, people will always kind of figure it out. They won't see the negatives. I think people forget very quickly that people do see the negatives in it. And if they've already had that viewpoint already, it's just going to make things worse for them. You know, they're not going to think, oh, well, you know, life as a blind person actually could be okay. They're not going to say, okay, so how does a blind person make a cup of tea? That's not going to be in their mind. We want it to be, but that's not where people are with these things. This is a silly challenge that's on Twitter. It's a throwaway fad, essentially. It's just another one of these things that comes along.
If I were to guess, it's come from YouTubers or bloggers who see this and they go, I can get material out of this. This is great. I can put a blindfold on. And not realising that being blind or being partially sighted takes a lot of skill, lots of creativity and lots of training. But that was the other thing that I read in that article, that you don't train people now by putting a blindfold on saying this is what it's like as a blind person.
No.
Because it's stereotyping, as we've been saying.
It's very interesting. You know, people don't realise that. You know, I remember growing up, I'm thinking about 6 or 7 years of involvement from social work departments when I was young, teaching me basic things, simple things like making cups of tea and, you know, carrying a cup of tea was even a thing. Getting around, mobility, all of that was trained. It's not something I just did.
Yeah.
So all the things I learned over the years, especially, you know, I started out, I think I was the age 6 or 7 when I first had involvement in that, where, you know, it was a case of let's learn early, let's get the knowledge in early. That was 6 or 7 years of my life. It continues to this day. If I need to go somewhere, if I need extra support, I may need to contact social work and say, look, I need to kind of figure out this route. It's quite complicated, quite difficult. You know, could someone help me with it? And then you have to get that training. So it's not just a case of you stick a blindfold on and suddenly these people that do that go, oh, well, I've just figured it all out. I've got the answer.
Yeah.
First of all, there's no secret here.
No.
I think I've noticed over the years the amount of people who spend time thinking that we are at it is incredible. Yeah. And that is reinforced by a number of people who, in the media, certain parts of the media, who portray images of disabled people as, well, you know, your benefits cheats, or, you know, you're just in it for the cash, or the disabled parking space.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
The majority of people, the massive majority of disabled people, are not like that. There are one or two bad people out there who will use a bad back as an excuse to, you know, get off work while, you know, they're off doing something else.
Oh, and I can park in the child and parent bit at the front of the supermarket.
But even more so, how many stories do you hear of someone who's got a bad back and then they're, you know, washing windows up
dancing.
A ladder?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, on that occasion, I can understand where people think, well, that's a disgrace. I think that's a disgrace.
It's a small minority,
It's a tiny number.
Yeah, tiny number.
Tiny number. So it opens up all these wounds for a lot of us again. I don't think anybody in life likes being told that a difficulty they've gone through can be easily fixed by a hashtag.
Yeah.
I think that's the problem.
I think we also heard from Robbie Crowe, who summed this up, saying it's not a case of that people are finding things hard to do because they're suddenly, you know, blind. It's because they're not used to it. It's not because you just lost your eyesight. If I was to suddenly lose my hearing or you lose your taste, then
exactly.
You've got years and years and years to get used to that kind of thing. So, oh, yeah, whoever thought this up is the same person who's walking in front of traffic, unfortunately. So, make
please,
of that what you
please
will.
Please don't do that.
Yeah, don't
just
do that.
Don't do that. You know, if you want some advice on this, you know, and I strongly encourage RNIB as well to use this as an opportunity to educate the public. You know, that even if it is as simple as, you know, how to make a cup of tea or how to cross a road, how do blind people cross the road safely? You know, we need to get that information out there.
Yeah,
that's our job to do that.
We'll be doing a lot more of that over this year on the show as well. I have a few ideas of how to do things as a blind or partially sighted person, just to educate people on if they've not used to it or if they've recently lost their sight. So there's a few things I've got lined up that we're going to get you to do.
Oh, great. I always love how you drag me into these things. But no, I think you're right. I think it's good to do. Okay, so people are getting in touch. And on Facebook as well, and on Twitter, we've got the Daily Connect poll running this week. How's that going?
Yeah, well, on Facebook, we are currently sitting at 25 people saying, yeah, it's a passing fad. It's just a meme of the week, if you want to call it that. 12 people are, I'm surprised by this, saying that it's just harmless fun. Just let people get on with it, you know.
Well, I noticed on our comments on Facebook as well, there are people saying, look, it's just a carry-on.
Yeah.
You know, we're not all, not everyone's taking it as seriously as others. You know, some people are saying it's just a joke. You know, I'm talking about blind people here.
Mm-hmm.
it is a mix of opinions. It's not all where... because, again, we don't all think the same way.
No. No, some people are going to think this is... We've done polls like that before where people have thought, oh, this is fine, just let people do what they want to do. It's entertainment. And then other people saying this is ridiculous. You're trivialising a very serious issue.
You can get involved in the Daily Connect poll. It's on Twitter and it's on Facebook. How long has it got to go?
Oh, days and days. We'll probably sum up again on Thursday or Friday, maybe.
Okay, yep, great.
Days to go.
Producer Andrew, thank you for coming in with that. This is The Daily Connect on RNIB Connect Radio. If you've got a view on this, give me a call on 0345 602 0025. Is it a good thing that we are in a position where, you know, movies like this are bringing up the topic of blindness? In a way, I mean, it's kind of wasn't really intended, I guess, but it did bring up the topic of living life with no ability to see or less ability to see. Is it a good thing? Is it a negative? Is it done in the right way in this case? Because it wasn't being done intentionally to be about blindness. Has that actually helped the cause because it's been able to bring up the topics? What do you think? 0345 602 0025. You can also get in touch on email radio@rnib.org.uk. Also, we're on Twitter and Facebook. You can get us there and take part in the Daily Connect poll, which you can find there. Just have a look for it on our Twitter feed, @RNIB Radio on Twitter. Search for RNIB Connect Radio on Facebook. That phone number again, if you're looking for it, is 0345 602 0025. Get in touch, join the conversation.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
So to come, we're going to talk about the CES exhibition, which is happening in Las Vegas at the moment, and all the various technology there. But first, let's talk about sports, and in particular, rugby. Now, Archie Labsley is visually impaired, and he thought he would try out sport, in particular rugby, by going along to his local club. But what were the challenges that he faced, and how did he overcome those, if any? Well, he spoke to Alan Russell and gave us a few hints and tips for those of you out there who might be thinking of doing the same this year.
What I really love is the variation in the position of the game. You know, there's so many different body types and different roles within a team that you get such different varieties of people in there, tall, some short, bigger people, some skinny, fast ones, who've got different skill sets and abilities. And I think that if you're going to have that variety in there, why shouldn't that include someone who's got less vision or less hearing or any other physical impairment? We've played it occasionally at school, and as part of that, we were invited down to the local rugby club. And when I got there, started playing a game. The thing that really got me into it was the team spirit that you feel and the sort of, you know, the belongingness that you get from being part of the team. There's so many different people with problems that may not be problems that are defined as visually impaired or any other thing, but everyone's got their own little individual nuances and challenges that they have to face. And as you're someone who is visually impaired, you sort of go through life thinking that you're the only person with a real problem. And it's when you get in that team, when you still really start to get to know people and start challenging yourself together, like playing rugby, that you realise that everyone's got these problems, and it's just that yours is in fact almost a more well-recognised problem, because you know, you're defined as being that issue. But everyone's got them, and it's just about finding out how to deal with them the best, and being in that team environment is an excellent way to deal with them. One of the things, so I have oculomotor albinism, which means that one of the most difficult things is depth perception. So passing the ball isn't particularly a problem, but catching the ball. So when the ball comes at you, it's really difficult to judge the speeds coming at you. But the thing that I've found is that the further away you stand, the longer the pass is, the more difficult it is to judge the speed it's coming from you. So all I do is just adapt my game and adapt my playing to taking sort of smaller, quick passes and supporting and being people's shoulders instead of having to take those massive, wide passes. The other thing a lot of people probably consider is that it seems like a lot more of an obstacle in everyday life, because you've got to read things and you've got to see fine detail, whereas on the pitch, there isn't any fine detail you need to see. You know, you're wearing different coloured shirts, and hopefully they're quite vibrantly different coloured team shirts, because I've had the problem where I've tackled my own team before, but the ball and different and the people are always quite big objects and clear objects to see, so you should just be able to work with what you've got and work with the vision you've got. You'll work out what is unique to you and what works best for you. So the team I play for is Milton Keynes Rugby Club, MKRFUC. The difference between coaching me, I find, or coaching someone with a visual impairment or any disability, is that it's communicate with the coaches and the more you talk to them about what it is, the easier it gets for them to then try and decide what the best way forward for you is. There isn't, as you say, try to say compensate, there isn't actually that much more that they're compensating for you than they're compensating for any player, because the whole point of the team is there's everyone with different weaknesses, but you're just trying to build on, almost overlap everyone's strengths with the weaknesses, so that there isn't anything left. So if you've got a bigger guy who can't run as fast, you know you're going to put him in a position and compensate a game for him that makes it mean he doesn't have to run as far. If you've got someone who's really quick, you aren't going to put him in the middle doing loads of physical things. So it's just about me, as I can't see very much. I said earlier, try not to catch the ball as much, you know, put myself in different positions and kickoffs and things, and just making the most of my strengths and what works really well for me. Not many people do know about albinism or about different eye conditions, and that's not through their own fault. It's just that there aren't many people with them, and they don't normally go and play rugby, and they're not really in those circles. And so one of the really nice things that I've learned from being in the team is that people, they may have come across rude at first, but really all they want to do is find out what it is. And once you take the time and you sort of polite and you explain different things and what you find easy and what you find hard, you do get really close with the club and close to the team, because everyone understands the challenge that's there for you, and they're all really willing to help out. And it's one of the lovely things about rugby as a whole. It's a very respectful game, and people are there to respect you and make sure you feel just as part of the team as anyone else.
Great to hear from Archie there. There's a longer interview with Archie on our RNIB Connect podcast. You'll find that with Alan Russell on this very podcast.
The Daily Connect podcast.
This is RNIB Connect Radio. Hello, it is Stephen Scott here with you. Producer Andy is in the studio. Hi, Andy.
I'm still here, yes, hello.
Let's talk about CES. It's the Consumer Electronics Show that happens every year in Las Vegas. Now, I'll be honest with you, Producer Andy, I didn't get the offer of tickets this year.
I was going to say, why are we not there?
I have no idea.
We could do the show live from Las Vegas.
Yeah, maybe not this one, but there is that other show
next
we do.
Year, yeah.
So, you know, maybe that tech talk show maybe one day. But no, at the moment, no. But it is an interesting show. And what is has been interesting to me, especially over the last 2 years, is the increase in the amount of technology for visually impaired people and disabled people more generally.
Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of this new tech coming out. Now, I will say this about the Consumer Electronics Show, for those who aren't really into all this tech stuff, they might hear about the CES show and think, well, this all sounds a bit far-fetched. Some of the technology sounds crazy. And actually it is, because the truth of the matter is this is really a showcase of what could be rather than what is. Some of the technology does come to fruition,
yeah,
but a lot of it is more about what the capability is or what the potential could be. Gives you an idea what companies are working on in the future. So we're seeing lots of crazy stuff. I mean, there is a lot of crazy stuff, but like smart toilets. I don't really understand what that is. I've heard of these Japanese toilets. I mean, the Japanese toilets are incredible. You know, they can wash you and they can clean you and they can do everything to you.
What else does it need to do?
Well, that's it. I mean, what else do I want it to do?
Do you
play
need
music?
It tell you the weather?
Yeah.
Just sat there contemplating.
It's a bit wet outside. Yeah. Not much better in here.
Quite windy today.
How dare you? Yeah, exactly. So how smart do you want your tech to be, I guess?
Yeah.
But let's kick off with the headlines. It's all really about TVs. It's about cars. It's about mobiles as well.
TVs are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So, yes, it's 8K TVs we're talking about now. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, hang on a second, 4K's only just come out. Mm-hmm. But no, apparently it's all about 8K TVs. Brands such as Samsung are at the forefront of this. I didn't know this, but human eye has a hard job of detecting anything above 4K in resolutions.
So this is someone with full 2020
vision.
Couldn't see it. Wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
So they're saying, is it a bit gratuitous to suddenly go up to 8K? I mean, how big does your TV need to be?
Well, it's not so much the size. It's this is the picture quality we're talking about.
Yeah.
So 8K, so that's, if you don't have a 4K television at the minute, if you've just got a standard television, a HD television,
yeah,
if your TV's got a little HD logo on it, that TV that you're talking about is 8 times the picture quality.
Mm. Yeah.
And the standard ones are 4 times.
The average screen size in 2009 was 36 inches. In 2019, it's going to be 48 inches. So that's going to be ideal for your 4K TVs.
Yeah.
But if you want an 8K TV, you're going to be talking about 70-inch sets. I mean, that's
which, you know, if you're sitting at home watching Jurassic Park, yeah, it's brilliant. But you're right. If you're watching EastEnders or Coronation Street, I don't know the point of that, really.
Yeah.
So TVs are the big thing, and they roll on. I've started to see 8K TVs appear in shops, so that's a reality. That is definitely here. That's not just coming, that's here.
Yep. Level 3 self-driving cars. Mm. This is one that you interested you, the smart laundry folding robot.
I love the sound of this.
So it's this big giant looking thing, and you put your unfolded clothes in, and apparently it comes out all neat and stuff. And yeah, I'm sure that every year we see the same story of, here's this robot that folds your laundry for you.
Yeah, I want someone to just develop it and get it out there. But I think you're right, this is an example of the kind of tech that comes out as prototype, not necessarily the reality. One thing that it has come out as again, a prototype of sorts, is due to appear in 2019. And this is actually specifically for us as blind people, and that is a smart cane. We're going to hear more about this now. I had a chance to catch up with the company who are actually exhibiting at CES 2019 in Las Vegas, and this is a company called WeWalk. They've developed this smart cane. Geddes Morgan spoke to me at RNIB's TechShare Pro in November last year to give us a flavour of what the device is all about and how it works.
We have developed a smart light cane for visually impaired people, and this has three features. First one, it has obstacle detection. There's a sensor on the cane, and if there's an object in the front, it vibrates. Secondly, it can be connected to phone via Bluetooth, and it has a touch screen, so the apps in the phone can be controlled using this touchpad. Wow. And thirdly, this will be open, and any third-party applications can use WeWalk and integrate WeWalk to their apps. And it also has microphone, gyroscope, like other sensors on it. So you can also interact with your phone via microphone. Mainly it will give navigation. And with this feature, we are using Google Maps database, and we get data from Google Maps to give navigation around. And when you have WeWalk, you don't have to take your phone out of your pocket, so you will have one of your hands free outside, and it will be safer to walk around, because otherwise anyone can steal your phone from your hand, but this will be safer and more easy usage. And there are other variables like watches that detect objects in front of you, but this is already connected in, this will be your smart cane, so you are already going to be using this cane. So it's very useful for visually impaired people.
That was Geddes Morgan there talking to me at RNIB's TechShare Pro event in November last year. The company, WeWalk, are actually exhibiting at CES in Las Vegas, so giving it a full show, I guess, and you know, even featured on CNN last night. They were talking to the guys there. So, you know, that's... it's a really interesting piece of kit that's coming out. This is apparently going to be out some point 2019, following a kind of Kickstarter type.
It is Kickstarter, yeah.
Yeah, so that's good. Let's talk about 5G, because 5G, we've got 4G at the moment, and 5G technology for our smartphones, for our tablets, is coming, and they're saying it's going to make a big difference.
Yeah, talking about going from 4K TVs up to 8K is just to make numbers, you know, keep them going and going and going. So this is 5G for your phones. Now, every generation of mobile phone right now is capable of carrying 4G. So going up to 5G, everything's going to be quicker and faster. It's going to be aimed, designed to connect people, but also connecting things. So I'm guessing maybe an alternative to Bluetooth?
And certainly making Bluetooth better and all those connections a bit better.
Yeah.
So it could be quite good. Yeah, so 5G coming. And, of course, we'll have to wait and see what the providers do. We'll get new iPhones, we'll get new Android phones, and all the new smartphones will have to update, as you say, to work with that. Because if you were to get a 5G contract today, your phone wouldn't work with it.
Yeah, so it comes to the major cities first and then kind of filters out towards the other places.
But 4G is not, you know, for anyone who worries about this, you know, if they've got a contract and you've got a 4G contract at the moment, say with O2 or Vodafone or whoever, nothing's going to change. You know,
no,
it's just another option you can have in the future. You don't have to just get rid of it.
I'm sure some people will still be on 3G. It still provides internet.
Yeah. 2G's gone, though. Poor old 2G.
Do you remember Edge as well?
Oh, Edge. GPRS.
GPRS, yeah. That was the one I used to get on trains. You were like, why am I on GPRS? Where's that come from?
Yeah. You said that on BT Cellnet.
God, we sound like that a pair of old...
Oh, the good old days. Yeah. Right, so let's talk about kettles, because I like a cup of tea.
Oh, we as do I. And one of the things I've always wanted to save up and buy is a smart kettle. So this is one that's been provided by Heatworks, which is on display at CES this year. It promises to be a kettle that will heat water as it's poured, which is strange to sound. So what's the big deal? It's essentially a water jug that promises to heat your water for tea or coffee or a neti pot if you want, or whatever your jam is, while you're pouring the water. So my assumption is it starts off cold, and at some point, as you're pouring, it's going to come a steaming hot cup of tea, so...
That's interesting, because you can get, right now, I use this, it's one cup. You get them from Breville. Mm-hmm. I think other companies do similar, but Breville, I think, is the kind of premier one. And you get this one cup, which you press a button, you put the cup underneath. I really like this because I have a real issue with making tea. We were talking about this earlier on the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, making a cup of tea and burning myself or misjudging the cup and then it flowing over. So the one cup's really good because as long as the cup size is right, it'll just fill up appropriate, you know, enough water. So you can put enough water in the cup and it just does it for you.
Yeah.
But when you press the button, it heats the water as it pours it. So it's kind of doing that already.
Ah, so it's the technology's there, so they're just improving it.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. It's not the best thing to describe this. It's not just a case of I'm lazy, I need something to do this for me. It's also going to be energy efficient. It's going to filter your water for you as well. So it's not just a case of I want a robot that does this thing for me.
No, I absolutely do want a robot to do that for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, for other people, they may feel slightly different about that. Okay. Now, you said to me you were going to save one for the end. This is called the Impossible Burger.
Yeah, they were at CES last year as well, where they launched the Impossible Burger, which is a original plant-based hamburger. And they've come back to this year with 2.0, so they improved taste. Last year's had a bit of a weird aftertaste, according to this Digital Trends article that I'm reading. They say that it tastes like overcooked corn, which is a bit of a worry. Mm. But they've come back this year, and they said everything, the smell, the colour, the texture, the flavour, it's all there. So, yeah, this is a plant-based hamburger. So it's not just technology in your phones and your TVs and your smartwatches and your kettles and your smart toilets. It's also food-related that these kinds of things come about. So if anyone from the company that behind Impossible Burger would like to send Stephen and I a sample, we'll be delighted to promote it on air.
Yeah, so maybe send a smart toilet afterwards as well. Well, thank you for that, Andy. That is your look at CES 2019. We'll continue looking at it through the course of the week. And we'll give you more information on Tech Talk as well, because we're going to do a special episode of Tech Talk coming up soon from, well, not from CES. I love that, but no, from it.
Fingers crossed next year.
Near it,
yeah.
As in, you know,
in the car park,
nowhere near, yeah, in the car park in Glasgow.
Yeah.
That's all coming up. We'll give you more details on that. This is RNIB Connect Radio,
the Daily Connect podcast.
Let's get back to our conversation now with John Nixie, who met up with our Lynn Morgan from our Cardiff studio. John has dual sensory loss and continued his conversation about composing music and one particular piece of music that has caught the attention of many.
John was asked by a friend if one of his compositions could be used in a memorial ceremony for the two young murder victims, Frieda Burnell and Florence Little.
Had your friend heard the piece, and did he know which piece of music he wanted you to set lyrics to?
Yeah, he was looking on YouTube, and he came across this one particular piece, and he couldn't stop playing it, he just fell in love with it. And he got in contact with me and told me about this event that he was going to have later in the year, and would I mind him using it, which of course I didn't mind in the slightest. I felt quite honoured. But then he dropped the bombshell and said he wanted lyrics written to it. And that's where I found the real challenge then, was writing some lyrics that were tactful, that described the story that happened to the two young girls who got murdered all those years ago. But I had to think of the family's feelings as well, because they were travelling from all over the country to this event, and I didn't want to cause any offence at all. So it had to be absolutely spot on.
The families presumably then heard it for the first time on the day of the memorial service.
Many of them had been sent copies of the lyrics to make sure that they were happy with the content. But by far the majority heard it for the first time on August the 4th, yeah.
Did you get any sort of feedback, John?
It was a very emotional afternoon, there's no doubt about that. And I had a lot of good feedback, and they thought it was very tactfully done. It turned out to quite an emotional piece, which I suppose under those circumstances is going to be... Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet any of the family on the day, which I suppose is understandable, because they're going to be quite wrapped up in their emotions. But I would have liked to have at least got to speak to one or two of them. But as the lyrics were being composed, Neil was sending them on to the family members to make sure that they were happy with what was coming out. And they were, and they said that they found it quite emotional, quite touching, and they thought that they were very suitable, which was all I needed, really, just the reassurance that what I'd done was right for them. But I mentioned to my friend that none of my music, apart from possibly one piece, ever to have lyrics written to them. Mm. But he was absolutely insistent that's what he wanted. And it probably took me about 2 weeks in all to do a few versions so he could choose from. And then, of course, we had to find the right choir to sing it. And as the notes were going quite high, it seemed obvious to get a ladies' choir to sing that. So the Abertillery Ladies Orpheus Choir agreed to take that on and perform in the afternoon event then. This is called My Valley Home, which I wrote back in 2000. And this is the Abertillery Ladies Orpheus Choir singing it at the memorial event on Saturday, August the 4th.
Valley Home, recorded at the memorial service in Abertillery for Frieda Burnell and Florence Flossie Little. Composed by John Nixie and performed by the Abertillery Ladies Orpheus Choir. If you're interested in hearing more about the Frieda Burnell and Florence Little story, you can watch Dark Sun, The Hunt for a Serial Killer on Saturday evening at 9 p.m. on BBC Two Wales.
Thank you, Lynn. And that rounds up our podcast for today. Back tomorrow, we've got the news review returning on the podcast tomorrow, as well as on air. You can listen to the show 10 till 12 live and get involved on the show as well. Or you can listen on the podcast just after 5 o'clock. Keep in touch as well. My email is radio@rnib.org.uk. Tell us what you think of the show. And your name could be featured on this very podcast and indeed on the show. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow. The Daily Connect Podcast.